You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Jarrett Adams spent nearly a decade in prison here in Wisconsin after a wrongful conviction for sexual assault. After getting his conviction overturned, his record expunged, he became an attorney himself, working with others who are wrongfully behind bars and with people who have long sentences for minor offenses. He shares his story in his new book, a firsthand account of some of the injustices in our criminal justice and prison systems and how he's trying to make them right. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know spent time in the criminal justice system? How did it impact life after getting out? What barriers to reentry did you encounter? Do you have questions for our guest about his experience and the justice system here in Wisconsin, which has the worst racial disparity for imprisonment in the entire country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jarrett Adams is an attorney and the author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate being back on.
Well, you've shared your story with us in the past. I want to focus in on a particular moment here. You write in your introduction, quoting, "In this country, we have two criminal justice systems, the one you can afford and the one you can't." Can you talk about how that system let you down? It worked differently for you and one of your then friends who was charged but was able to afford an attorney. Can you talk about that double system?
Yeah, it's a double system for sure. I mean, and you don't have to just take my words for it. You can look at the numbers and they glaringly show it. In my case in particular, there were three of us accused of the sexual assault. Only one of my friends was able to afford an attorney. Me and my other co-defendant, you know, we were assigned an attorney off of a panel list. And that directly impacted my case so much so that the retained attorney for my friend was filing motion after motion after motion. My attorney and my other co-defendant's panelist attorney as well never joined in this motion. They never gave us the opportunity to. They made the decision to proceed forward to trial. And it was the fork in the road that took almost a decade of both of our lives.
And that's one of the most frustrating parts of your story to read, the interactions you had with lawyers during your trial. Can you talk about how that system let you down? And you write, it's not just that it's the lawyers themselves. Those public defenders are often overwhelmed with many cases.
They definitely are. And in particular, in my case, we didn't get public defenders. You know, the public defender's office was conflicted out. So we were assigned attorneys off of a panel list in the state of Wisconsin and in other states as well. There's a panel list of attorneys who are assigned cases by the court. And the problem with that is this. First of all, the amount of pay is so low that you don't get the best representation. Not many attorneys are going to go do cases for $50 an hour or $70 an hour. And so that was, you know, a big issue in my case as well. And then, you know, it's one of these things, Rob, where you're on an island and you are facing the might of the entire system. They're not playing when they say state versus whoever it is. And it was just glaring. No investigator was hired in my case. And I thought it was just me. When I got to prison and when I started to meet other men and helping them with their cases and learn about their cases, I saw this across the board.
You spent time almost 10 years in Wisconsin's prison system, and you write that for people there wrongly or who are guilty, you don't see the prison system doing a lot of good to turn them around. What were some of the biggest flaws, the problems you saw in Wisconsin prisons?
You know, it's just, first of all, there's overcrowding. It's way too many people who are in prison, and they are in prison as a result of these old draconian sentences and in the ways in which we feel like lock them up, throw away the key forever. And so, you know, you're in this prison, and these mandatory sentences, they are the seed for hopelessness. If people know that they're going to be in prison, no matter how good they are, no matter how much they change and how much they reform, if they know they're going to be in prison for two decades, there's no incentive for them to do anything positive at all. So that was one of the biggest things. Another thing is this, Rob, there's no correcting at all going on. You're being warehoused in this prison, and you're pretty much just getting up, going to sleep, getting up, going to sleep. There has to be an investment in the people that are there, inmates are people as well. And you just don't see the educational, you know, tools being handed out. Most people who are incarcerated will go home at some point. And we are doing a horrible job of preparing people to reintegrate back into society.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Jarrett, something I hadn't known until I read your book, you ended up in Bosco Bell, once called the Supermax prison in Wisconsin, billed as being this site for the worst of the worst in the prison system. How did you end up there?
So you know that old saying in baseball, if you build it, they will come? That's exactly what Boscoville was. There was this rush to build this sparkling brand new facility for the worst of the worst. And it was one of these things where they took the Jeffrey Dahmer murder and they used that to scare people into getting the funding to build this prison. And when they built it, there was no worst of the worst like that. There was only a handful of people who you could say even, you know, deserved or met the criteria to be there. So what they did was this. They started to, like almost like a quota ticket system, they started to create allegations of confidential informants and putting people in segregation for 360 days at a time. And they swept me up in one of those. And they did this in large part because I continued to litigate against the Department of Corrections, their handbook, and some of the things that we weren't getting access to education-wise in there. So it's just, it was one of these things where you had this message going out that it was necessary, that it was needed, but then you saw people going there for, they broke off the front of their razor to get a close shave, or, you know, this person had food in his cell. And it just was ridiculous. And I don't think anyone really looked under the hood until, you know, they had so many people packed and the litigation finally opened up Boscoville to a normal prison that it is now.
Okay, Jarrett, you spend almost, again, 10 years. You've been working on your case the whole time. The Innocence Project helps out. Finally, you get the conviction overturned. Your record was expunged. If you had said, I'm going to stay as far away from prisons and the legal system as I possibly can, I would get it. You went the opposite direction. What made you decide to become a lawyer and work to prevent this from happening to other people?
You know, I will, there are certain things that I will never forget, you know, being in prison for so long. And one of the things isn't an act of violence. It was looking at the creases of pain and anguish on my mother's face. You know, I'll never forget seeing that. And I also acknowledge this. Look, this started because I told my parents I was going to spend the night over a friend's house. My friends told their parents they were spending the night over my house. So we snuck to Wisconsin to go to this party. And it just was the worst fears realized. I now know why my mother was creative and keeping me busy in the summer. And, you know, all type of things that African-American parents have to do to keep their kids out of trouble. And so when I came home, I knew I had a penchant for the law, and it became a passion, and I was driven to remove the wrinkles and creases of anguish off of other mothers' faces as well.
You had vowed you wouldn't come back to Wisconsin unless you did it as an attorney. Can you share this moment, you share it in the book, at the state capitol, I think it was, when you were sworn into the Wisconsin bar?
You know, I was sworn into the Wisconsin bar by Keith Finley. So it was
of the Innocence Project.
Yeah, of the Innocence Project. And so it was really, you know, really a dream type moment, you know, to hear him, you know, swear me in, you know, motion that I get in and I be accepted and acknowledged by all of the justices. And I'll make this point too, Rob. If the justices, if the courts could see me as I am now, when I was a 17-year-old, I never would have been sentenced to 28 years in prison. And so I think it's a point that I want to emphasize on, and I enjoyed the moment and it inspired me to keep going to create other Jarrett Adams.
We're talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced the criminal justice system on either side as someone accused of a crime, somebody defending that person, somebody prosecuting it? Have you seen somebody in your family go through this experience? Have you yourself? What could we do better, do you think, here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. It's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Jarrett Adams about his new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Now an attorney, he was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in jail, or in prison, I should say, before the conviction was overturned, his record expunged. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Alicia is with us in Portage. Alicia, hi. Alicia, are you there? Nope. Let's go to Vivian then in Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. I am a product of a very rural Wisconsin community. I'm in my 70s and watching exposés going back to the New York Five to so many things through the Innocence Project, I think justice system is a misnomer. And when anyone refers to it that way, I say we don't have a justice system, we have a judicial system, and I've never had any encounters in that system, but I don't see it as a justice system.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. Jarrett, what do you think of Vivian's distinction?
I agree, and it's, you know, it's encouraging, you know, to have, you know, someone in Green Bay in their 70s who's been around a while and seen a lot in life, you know, to acknowledge that. And now we just need the officials, the lawmakers, to acknowledge it as well. We have a system that pounds people, especially people of color. One in every 36 Black Wisconsin adults is incarcerated in a state prison in Wisconsin. I mean, that number should make everyone drop what they're doing and turn their attention to fixing this system.
Thanks for that call, Vivian, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Pierre in La Crosse. Pierre, hi.
Yeah, I am calling because the justice system, there is a white justice system and there is a Black justice system, which you can't even say call justice system, because I have a family member that was charged with a crime. They charged with the highest crime. In order for them to just try to negotiate it to a lower crime, where they should have charged them that in the first place. And in the same person, they were charged high with a felony. And I know another person that did almost the same crime. They got charged with two different felony, but that person with the two different felony ended up having no probation, nothing to do because they were white. And that other family member ended up having to be on probation for a year and paying a whole bunch of fines that he cannot even afford.
Pierre, thanks for the call. Is this a common story, you think, Jarrett? Two different systems, Pierre says, depending on race.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think people should you know, just look at the numbers. You know, look at the recent article that came out. You know, in Wisconsin, 42% of the state prison population in 2019 was African Americans. I mean, just think about that. Think about the number of residents in the population in Milwaukee, which is the biggest jurisdiction where the African-American population is. I mean, if you think about the men that we have incarcerated and you think about the issues that exist within the inner cities, you're taking away a proponent that could fix, that can change, that can mentor. We're literally throwing away people with this truth in sentencing. And it was ran on the basis of, let's do truth in sentencing. Let's, you know, have all of these sentences where we give this time and they have to complete it because it'll make us safer. Rob, it's not safer. It's not.
Pierre, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Pierre's call reminds me, Jarrett, he talked about, you know, being charged with one thing and settling for a lesser offense, something you learned from your personal experience. And then again, as an attorney, is a lot of times people, especially maybe a young person in that situation, it's complicated. Courts are complicated things. They may not be getting good advice when they're making that kind of decision on the spot.
Absolutely. And there's also this, Rob. Look, people make decisions sometimes to get out of the pain that they're in. And I met a number of different men who pled guilty just to get out of the Milwaukee House of Corrections, only to come back and go to prison because they were on parole. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to inject in our system is this. We have to get more therapists, social workers, forensic psychologists. We need to allow the world of therapy to mend this system. I mean, I'm talking about both ends, right? I'm talking about both correctional officers. I've seen and have befriended some correctional officers who come in to these jobs and within, you know, a year or even months, I mean, it's almost like they're an inmate as well. They're feeling the effects of this system, which is telling us something. The system isn't working.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney. He was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in Wisconsin prisons. His new book is called Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, wrongfully convicted. You're in prison for so long, 360 days in segregation, as we mentioned, at Bosque Bell. What got you through?
You know, I had a round table of angels and my mother and my two aunts, and I opened the book up, Redeeming Justice. The first page is a dedication to them. And what they would do is they would write letters in a staggered approach. One would write a letter on Monday, the other on Wednesday, the other on Friday. And they would write these letters and they would, you know, have Bible verses inside of them. And, you know, I asked my aunt, you know, because she would give me like the newspaper subscription. I would get it late. And I asked her, I said, why do you, you know, send this paper still and you guys write these letters? I hear from you guys enough. I'll talk. And she says, no, listen, there's a reason why we're doing it. And a reason why we're doing it is this. We've acknowledged that they've confined your body, but you can never let them incarcerate your mind. And that was one of the things that kept me getting through. You know, when I came home and I was on a race pace to get this law degree. And I remember my boss at the time, I was working at the Federal Defender, you know, she was just like, you know, look, you got to take a break. Like, what are you, you know, moving so fast for? And the real reality, Rob, was this, that decade wasn't just stolen from me. It was stolen from my family as well. I was cookouts, fish fries before I went to prison. I come home, there's dialysis treatments, there are visits in old folks' homes. So I was racing because I wanted my aunts to see me get this law degree. And I was fortunate enough to get that done before my aunt Josephine passed away.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tina is with us in Shawano. Tina, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, I've been a practicing attorney in Wisconsin for almost 34 years now. And I've been a prosecutor a couple times. I've been a defense attorney. I've been a social services attorney. I've been a judge on a few occasions. And, you know, my observation is that our system is not only broken, it's completely corrupt. You know, not only do we treat, you know, people of color, you know, differently, substantially differently, you know, it's really all about money. The courts have to, it's like any other bureaucracy, the courts have to make money. And they charge fines that no one can pay. No one can pay those, even if they have, you know, a decent job, which in Shawano is like $14 an hour. You know, they don't take an effect, you know, how this process affects families. You know, they drag out cases. They overcharge. They over-sentence. I mean, it's completely corrupt. It doesn't work at all. And if we want a system that works, we have to provide more of it. You know, for lack of a better word, in the Native American community, would call it a healing program.
Tina, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective. And Jarrett, that reminds me, part of your work now is on wrongful convictions. You're also worried about what Tina mentioned there, overcharging people for lesser crimes, either longer prison systems, sentences, or as Tina mentioned, unpayable fines.
Absolutely. I mean, Tina was spot on with that. We over punish and pummel the poor. In our society, I want people to understand there are people in living in the inner city, you know, in Milwaukee, where every dollar and penny is accounted for month to month. And so, you know, a speeding ticket, a red light camera ticket or something like that can throw them off of their entire budget. You know, I also want to point out this, you know, I'm representing a guy right now, Antoine Robinson. You know, he was convicted of an armed robbery along with his co-defendant who was Caucasian. His co-defendant, you know, received a significantly less sentence and has been home now for quite some time, after only serving about 7 years. Mr. Robinson has been in prison now for the last 20 years on an armed robbery where no one was killed and no one was shot. It makes absolutely no sense why we can't even get a court to consider really using the law of sentence modifications. It's just, we have to overhaul the system, and that overhaul has to be more than just changing the faucet. We need to rip up the floor and change the pipes.
Jarrett, just in our last minute, do you see that happening anytime soon, that kind of reform, that kind of overhaul?
Well, it's anything like this on this grand scale is going to take a lot of folks, a lot of time and a lot of resources. And this has to be spearheaded by the law schools as well as the judicial system and the lawyers and prosecutors. Everyone has to have an all hands on deck approach. And I'll use this as an example. We just dealt with the pandemic where for a while, people stopped fighting with each other because we were fighting this deadly virus. And you know, what we did was come together and figure it out. And then we went back to fighting each other. But the point I'm making is, if we all came together and decided to make change, real change, systematic change, where we got diverse people on the bench and in the prosecutor's office, we would have a much better system and we would have much better communities than we have right now.
Jarrett, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You guys have me back anytime.
That's Jarrett Adams, attorney and author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more. Articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why are the words new, N-E-W, and so, S-E-W, pronounced so differently, even though they're just one letter apart? We'll talk to a linguist whose latest book looks at the oddities of the English language and where they came from. Now, President Biden was in Tokyo yesterday for the launch of a new economic framework in the Indo-Pacific region. Former President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, when he came into office 5 years ago. Since then, the U.S. has been in an uncertain position when it comes to leadership in the region. This new thing is called the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity. It's not a full-on negotiated trade deal like the TPP. So what is it? And what does it mean for the American economy? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of some kind of rebuilt economic bloc in the Pacific with the U.S. part of it? What questions you have about the United States could benefit or not from a new economic framework launched in Tokyo this week? Where does China fit into all of this? And do you personally want to sell more stuff in your line of work to that part of the world? Or does your business rely on buying stuff from the region? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Kristen Vacasey is an associate professor of political science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. Her areas of expertise include international political economy, the geopolitics of supply chains, and Northeast Asia. And she earned her PhD in political science from UW-Madison. Kristen, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me. So happy to be here today.
All right, let's look first at this thing, this framework. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this long process, carefully negotiated tariffs and blah, blah, blah. What is this thing and how does it compare?
Absolutely. So during the Obama-Biden administration, there was a move to try and be a rulemaker in the Indo-Pacific region, or what we call now the Indo-Pacific region. And particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this effort to show economic leadership through building new standards, through increasing market access, through lowering non-tariff barriers, having shared investment standards, and even a few labor and environmental standards were thrown in there as well. It was painstakingly negotiated. And then during the 2016 election, it got very much thrown out under the bus by both the Democratic and Republican candidates. And on his first day in office, President Trump said he was throwing it out, much to the dismay of the other members of the agreement. Now, in response to that, Japan in particular took leadership in the TPP, and the remaining countries did sign something now known as the CPTPP. And there really still is a lot of appetite in Northeast Asia and across the whole Indo-Pacific region for these really detailed, comprehensive kinds of trade agreements in order to integrate supply chains, et cetera. So when Biden comes into office, he's faced with this challenge of how does the United States try and show economic leadership in this really prosperous part of the world that is eager for more interconnectivity and eager for like real rulemaking without making the same domestic political mistakes that were made with the TPP. And right now, his answer is this Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which maybe we could say IPEF, but maybe we can just go with IPEF.
Yeah, it doesn't roll off the tongue exactly, IPEF. Now,
a
lot of this is defined by an absence here. The TPP did not include China. This IPEF, or whatever we're going to call it, doesn't include China. How big a part of the story is saying we'd rather have the United States be part of this kind of trade than let China dominate it?
That's a great question. So to some extent, there is eagerness to build a set of shared rules and standards in the region, whether it comes from the United States or China or Japan or whichever large economy is going to take that lead. There's eagerness, and you can see this. There's a whole constellation of trade agreements, of economic partnership agreements, of bilateral investment treaties, including the CPTPP, but also agreements like the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, which was signed last year and does include China, as well as most, not all, but most of the countries that are also involved, part of this new IPEF. And so to some extent, countries will join all of them. The countries, they're joiners. They'll join all of these agreements. But to some extent, the deliberate exclusion of the world's second largest economy from this agreement is showing that the United States would like to be a leader and take leadership in the region independent of China.
We're talking to Kristen Vacacy from the University of Maine, looking at this loose trade agreement signed between President Biden and a bunch of countries in Asia, Australia, the Indian Ocean region as well. It's not the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about all this at 800-642-1234. Are you glad the U.S. got out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Should we be trying to get back into it? What do you want to see? What do you want our economic relationship be with countries in that big region? And how about China along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen, there are some kind of main principles that are part of this framework for prosperity, as the administration is calling it. One of them, and you mentioned supply chains, and that's been obviously a huge issue this last couple of years. That's a big part of this, supply chain resilience. What are people talking about here?
Yeah, so we have seen supply chain disruptions, many of which were caused by the pandemic, but there's also other economic issues that have caused some of these supply chain issues that are contributing to inflation right now. The supply chain resiliency initiatives in this agreement are trying to have better information sharing, transparency in supply chains in order to guard against the kinds of price spikes and the kinds of supply disruptions that we've been seeing for the last few years. Now, you might think of things like semiconductors, and that might be part of this agreement. Taiwan is not part of the agreement, which is a large supplier of semiconductors. So maybe that's something we could talk about. But one of the things that's specifically mentioned are minerals. And in the initial fact sheet from the White House. And we rely on China for a lot of critical minerals like rare earths. But there's also, these minerals are also found within the region and the countries that are part of or have signed on initially to the IPEF. And they include things like rare earth minerals, but also things like nickel and other minerals that we need to make batteries, to make permanent magnets, to make all the sorts of fancy technologies that enable our modern life and will help us transition from fossil fuels.
We sometimes hear from the Biden administration and others the solution to the supply chain, the international supply chain problem, is to make more stuff here, to try to make the United States a manufacturer of microchips and some of the other things you just mentioned. Is that at odds with trying to get together with all these other countries and make sure that the stuff flows from there to here more easily?
I don't think it is at odds. It's with things like chips as well as with minerals in current demand, but even more predicted demand in the future is so high that we need all of them, plus. And one of the benefits of an agreement like this, if it follows the path that we see in the initial language, is that you would have shared production standards, shared confidence that if a chip or a refined metal was made in one of the countries that's in the agreement, you would be getting the same quality and the same sort of process, hopefully the same environmental standards, the same labor standards in any of these countries, and it would facilitate imports and exports. And I think that also would help build more resilience for American manufacturing if it's done right.
Here in Wisconsin, we got a lot of manufacturing, a lot of agriculture. That was a lot of the focus here on Trump administration agreements with China, for example, the hope that we'd be able to sell more of that stuff to them. That never seemed to really come to fruition. Are these things we're talking about with these countries as part of this framework for prosperity?
To some extent, one of the critiques of the IPEF right now is that it's unclear what sorts of things the United States is going to offer to member countries or ask of member countries. You know, it's kind of clear what the Biden administration wants a end map to look like with, you know, supply chain resiliency, clean economy, some things with digital economy and whatnot. But it's unclear what that might mean for market access going either way. And that absence is something that we'll really need to pay attention to over the next few months as countries start to negotiate.
We're talking right now about a new economic framework President Biden and leaders of a dozen other countries rolled out yesterday for the Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean region. It's a big region. Our guest is Kristen Vacacy, Associate Professor of Political Science at the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see get hammered out between the U.S. and all these trading partners in the Pacific region? What do you think about China's influence there? Are you glad the U.S. is trying to take an active leadership role in trade in the area? Would you want to go back to something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiated under the Obama administration, rejected early on in the Trump administration? Do you have worries about trade with a lot of these countries? Call 800-642-1234. With your questions, your comments, that's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about a new launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework this week. That's a deal between the U.S. and a bunch of countries, including India, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Indonesia, many more, establishing trade guidelines, cooperation guidelines on economic issues between these countries, but not a full-on trade agreement like the canceled Trans-Pacific Partnership. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions on the U.S. role in that region, what you'd hope for from trade agreements, loose or tight with those countries. Your hopes for something that might affect your own business, maybe. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen Vacasey stays with us, Associate Professor of Political Science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. Kristen, if this isn't like a full-fledged negotiated agreement like the TPP, does it really matter? Does it make a difference? Or is there something significant here?
That's a great question. So one of the reasons that this is not a trade agreement is it makes it more plausible that President Biden will be able to make some agreements in a shorter time frame with these partner countries. And so the goal right now is sort of the 12 to 18 months, there'll be some announcements of what's come out of the IPEF. And that can be done with executive action rather than votes by Congress. Now, the benefit of that is the shorter timeframe, but of course, that also means that partner countries might be skeptical that the commitments the United States makes and the agreements will last past a single administration. And so that's a risk in negotiation and might lead to they're more watered down agreements and maybe not as strong of rulemaking as you might see under a trade agreement. But it does allow the Biden administration and perhaps also the governments in Japan, South Korea, other member countries to be a little bit more to have a little bit more flexibility in their negotiations because it's a lower level than a trade agreement. So I'm hoping my optimistic view is that we're going to see some lively negotiations towards sort of the low hanging fruit in negotiations, things maybe the easier things on digital governance, maybe some things on shared standards, et cetera.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in River Falls. Jim, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I guess, when they negotiated the TPP, my concern about that was it was mostly negotiated behind closed doors with these major corporations having a lot of input into it. They didn't have human rights groups or environmental groups provide a lot of input into those agreements. And my understanding was that that would have benefited companies. It would have given them basically autonomy in areas where they had the corporations that they weren't subject to like our national laws or federal laws here or state or local ordinances either. So it was a win-win for the corporations, I think, but not necessarily for working people or, people that are abused in foreign sweatshops.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And Jim really sums up very nicely, I think, Kristen, a lot of the objections to the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the first place.
Absolutely. And that's a great comment and a great question. So indeed, some of the big concerns that we saw were things like lack of transparency in the negotiating process. I think that the coverage of this question of supranational autonomy of MNCs with the TPP was a bit overblown but there were also concerns that the TPP didn't take labor concerns seriously enough, that it didn't take environmental concerns seriously enough, and particularly those are things that where the United States has typically higher environmental and labor standards than the partner countries. And so if we don't have shared standards and shared rules, that gives American industry and American manufacturing a really big structural disadvantage. And so the language of the IPEF includes those concerns. It indicates that the Biden administration witnessed what happened with TPP and said, okay, on this next round, we are going to focus on those issue areas that had such large political problems in the TPP negotiations. Now, that does not guarantee a different outcome, but it does show attention to these problems. And in trade negotiations typically are private, and they do involve countries giving up sovereignty and then agreeing to rules that are shared across borders instead of being made at a national congressional level. And those certainly introduce the tension between national sovereignty and international agreements.
Thanks again. Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking with Kristen Vacacy from the University of Maine, looking at President Biden's trip and dealing with international trade partners in Asia and the Indian Ocean region, a loose framework kind of agreement, nothing as precise as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Kristen, another absence here. You mentioned Taiwan, a big economic power in its own right, not part of this deal. Taiwan in a weird position diplomatically. It's its own country, clearly, except China says it isn't. Diplomatically, people have to deal with it, pretend it doesn't exist. The U.S. policy has been strategic ambiguity, not saying whether or not we'd defend Taiwan if China attacks it. President Biden saying, yeah, we would. Can you talk about the Taiwan issue here?
Absolutely. So it's always difficult to talk about Taiwan because of the where there's a linguistic dance around the one China policy about recognition of Taiwan or non-recognition of Taiwan, but acknowledging China's policy that Taiwan is not a country. There's a lot of difficulties here. Most heads of state from around the world have messed this up. And the government in China typically responds in an aggravated way, as is what happened this time as well. Strategic ambiguity, the goals to try and deter China from a military takeover of Taiwan, perhaps something like what we see happening in Ukraine right now. So deterrence without aggravation. And so to maintain the status quo. Biden's statement was more straightforward. And this is not the first time he's made such a statement. It's the third time. I don't think that it really changes Beijing's understanding of what the United States would do, although there's, of course, a robust debate about that. But I think the United States has been pretty clear that we would defend Taiwan since the Taiwan Straits crisis in the mid-1990s when we brought the fleet in. And indicated that indeed we would defend Taiwan. So I think it's strategic ambiguity, but there actually has been less ambiguity. But this question, this political question of Taiwan, we do see it playing out in the IPEF. Here's a place where we do see U.S.-China rivalry in the region affecting what happens in economic agreements. So countries like Malaysia, the Philippines, Thailand, it would aggravate their relationship with China if they joined an agreement where Taiwan was also a member. And so although there was interest in bringing Taiwan into the IPEF, they were not invited for these political reasons.
Now, briefly, if we're trying to work, as part of this is the supply chain stuff like we were talking about earlier. If we don't have Taiwan in here, which provides so many of the chips that, you know, a bunch of cars and parking lots in the Detroit area are waiting for, we don't include China, which if it shuts down Shanghai, say, because of COVID, we feel it here in the United States. How much supply chain can we fix without those two?
Sure. So there are we're doing things to fix the supply chain without this agreement. And hopefully Taiwan will be brought into some of these regional agreements at some point. They have, for example, applied for membership in the TPP, and that probably would help alleviate some of the chip issues. But I think that broader regional cooperation in standard setting would help alleviate supply chain issues, but that the political reality on the ground is that the United States needs to start here, and then maybe over time can start to incorporate some of those other countries.
And just our last half a minute, Kristen, what are you watching for next on this framework?
I'm watching to see the countries can choose which pillar of the four pillars they want to join. I'm waiting to see which countries will choose which pillars and whether we'll do bilateral or multilateral negotiations.
Kristen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That's Kristen Vacacy, Associate Professor of Political Science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. We talked with her today about a new economic framework, they're calling it. President Biden and leaders from a dozen Pacific countries laid out this week for the region, what it could all mean for the U.S. and for some of the supply chain issues still plaguing the U.S. economy and the rest of the world, for that matter. You can keep sharing your thoughts on this or any issue. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR or make comments over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and share these conversations over at WPR.org or use the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a Wisconsin author shares stories of historical American figures in children's book form. Join the conversation about kids' books starring real people and what children can learn from them. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Once upon a time, payphones were all over the place. If you don't remember that time, it was pretty straightforward. You put some coins in the phone, you make your call, you hope somebody answers. Or if you were in a suspense movie, a payphone would ring as you walked by, and answering it would draw you into a dangerous web of international intrigue. It's no secret that those days are over, but here's a new milestone. As reported by NPR, the last public payphone has been removed in New York City. There's still a few private ones up, lovingly protected by nostalgic fans, but unless you go looking for those, you're not going to run into a payphone in the whole Big Apple. How about you, community? Do you still have a payphone near you? When was the last time you used one? Let us know. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. And hey, take a picture of that payphone with your cell phone. Hey, maybe that's why they went away. Please deposit 25 cents to continue this call. This is Central Time.